for Kerry's election, but I think that we've got to make a change.
That was the Reverend William Shaw, president of the National Baptist Convention, endorsing John Kerry for president last week. President Kerry's been making a number of visits into churches, and that was the first that I'd heard a national religious figure endorsing a presidential candidate. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about the religious left here in this hour of Issues Etc. We have heard so much over the last decades, and with increasing strident tones about the religious right, the danger that the religious right poses to the American political system, and the religious right is undeniably a fixture of American politics. Is there such a thing as the religious left? And if so, what is the religious left? What are the beliefs that underpin this movement? And are there any similarities between the right and the left when it comes to the religious left and the religious right? Dr. Ron Nash will be our guest here. I invite your questions and your comments at 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, and we can take your questions and comments via the email as well here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. The number again, 1-800-730-2727. We're going to be talking about the religious left. Dr. Ron Nash is our guest. He's professor of Christian philosophy at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and author of the book, Why the Left Is Not Right, the Religious Left, Who They Are, and What They Believe. Dr. Nash, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Tom.
You write something very interesting in the middle of your book. You say, if there is anything we have learned thus far, it is that sooner or later, representatives of the evangelical left will proclaim that they are neither right nor left, neither conservative nor liberal. What's going on here? Is there a religious left, even though so many claim that they are neither right nor left?
Oh, there sure is. In fact, every 4 years they pop up. There's a line from an awful, awful movie that I never saw. It goes like this, they're back. And every 4 years they come out of the woodwork and they have the same message. They're not liberals. They want us to believe that they're centrists. But not only are they liberals, but they're to a great extent Marxists of one type or another. They've been doing this. I've been watching these people for 25, 30 years. I've read their books, and every once in a while I get upset enough to write a book. My book is out with two titles now, actually. I didn't like the title that Zondervan gave it originally, Why the Left Is Not Right. So it's out now with a different title, just called The Religious Left, and it's really everything you need to know about these people who teach, as a matter of fact, in a large number of so-called Christian colleges, and one of them, I won't name him now, I may name him a little later on, has said in writing that when he speaks to audiences, and often these guys do speak to huge audiences, Tony Campolo, who's one of them, he speaks to audiences of up to 20,000 people at Urbana every 3 years. And one of these fellows said, my major objective is to turn every young kid, every Christian kid I can, into a political liberal. And in fact, in some cases, these guys actually persuade them to become theological liberals, too. And this is going on at some Christian colleges. So we live in a day when we can hardly turn the television set on without hearing somebody lambaste the religious right, when in fact the people who are really dangerous to America and dangerous to the Christian church are advocates of the religious left.
Let's get a little bit of who and what initially in our conversation, Dr. Nash. You mentioned Tony Campolo, a professor of sociology at Eastern College. Name some others, if you would, and if possible, some organizations that you would say are squarely affiliated with the religious left.
Yeah, well, in my book, I talk about three people in particular. I call them the three amigos of the religious left, with deference, I suppose, to a horrible movie that played, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Tony Campolo is now retired from the sociology department at Eastern Baptist University. Jim Wallace teaches at Eastern Baptist seminary. I'm not sure either one of them is a Baptist. Jim Wallace, who was one of the ringleaders of the religious left, runs an organization in Washington, D.C., and called the Sojourners, and he publishes a magazine which appears, maybe it appears every 2 months now. It's called the Sojourners, and those are the three ringleaders. But if we could get on a bus and take a journey across America and just stop at Christian colleges across America, I could take you into the classrooms of a whole lot of people teaching at colleges that most Christians trust that and do not know enough about, who are strongly committed to either left-wing political ideology, far to the left of, I don't know if anybody's to the left of John Kerry, but they're sympathetic to Marxism. In fact, during the last years of the Cold War, some of these fellows, some of these liberal professors actually supported the Soviet Union whenever they shot down an airplane or found other ways to do harm to people. Of course, the Soviets, thanks to Ronald Reagan, are people that are much more interesting these days. In fact, I've made a number of trips to the Soviet Union, to Russia, since their revolution, and made a lot of friends, and in fact have a great deal of love and affection for the hundreds and thousands of Russian people that I've met and spoken to. So they're all over the place, and if your children happen to go to the wrong colleges, you're going to have a sociology prof or a prof in some other department who will be out there trying to persuade them that John Kerry is a fine Christian brother, and he provides a God-given alternative to the wickedness of George W. Bush.
Let me see if I can test this by example. I went to what is, by reputation, a very conservative Christian college in the Midwest. Now, we're going back 20 years.
Yeah.
But there was a professor of history there. I don't even know if he still serves there. Maybe he does. And he was into what was called liberation theology. He taught history according to this theological framework that basically all of history is a struggle between the haves and the have-nots, the oppressed and those who wanted to be liberated. And I remember this was during the days of the Contras and of the Sandinistas, yeah, and of the whole Central and South American struggle there. And I'm wondering, was I dealing with the proponent of the religious left at this very conservative Midwest Lutheran college?
Yeah. Do you want to name the city? Don't name the college, but just name the city.
It was Seward, Nebraska.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that was liberation theology. This fella had been indoctrinated in Marxism. What happened to other evangelical colleges, they often set up field trips and went down to Nicaragua to watch how the communist government of the Sandinistas operated. I have a friend who was from Nicaragua. He and I wrote a book together called "Why the Left." Beyond Liberation Theology. When you write so many books, the titles sort of run into each other. And after the Sandinistas were kicked out and were found to have robbed the treasury and engaged in all kinds of immoral, illegal activity, they were replaced by a woman named it's been too long. But anyway, my friend ended up Secretary of Education in the new and democratic Nicaraguan regime. Yeah, but that fellow was a liberation theologian. In fact, that stuff is just hardcore Marxism. In fact, that's a version of Marxism that most liberation theologians have abandoned because it's been disproven and discredited. But I guess I better stop because we've got other fish to fry here.
Yeah, but just as an aside, it's odd that you say that there were field trips because that's precisely what happened every summer. He took a group of students, history students, usually graduate students, down to Central America to visit the Sandinistas.
Yeah.
Now, why should we even worry about this? What is it that the religious left, if you could put it in a nutshell, believes that that you would say, as you said before, represents a greater threat than the religious right in American politics?
Well, here's how they seduce good Christian kids into their ideology. They persuade them that conservatism is evil and that liberals care more for poor people and needy people than anybody else does. And that if your parents voted for Ronald Reagan, that was a sin. If you vote for George W. Bush, that's sin. And then what follows is a collection of lies and distortions. A lot of Christian kids have not been exposed to this kind of an attack. And because they trust their professors, they naturally believe what their professors say, especially if they go down to these training trips to places like Nicaragua, as they did about 15 years ago would be about the time. They're presented with just a particular message. Somebody controls very strictly what they see and what they hear. And one of the messages they get is that they're watching the kingdom of God being established on earth by Marxists. So the religious left is simply a kind of an arm of liberation theology, although I will say this, thanks largely to the efforts of the current pope, liberation theology was brought to a kind of a stop in Latin America. So that, ironically, the countries in which Marxian liberation theology are the strongest right now are the United States and Canada. And a lot of that goes on in Christian seminaries and Christian colleges.
You talk about three major groups of the religious left, so we can focus our conversation here. The first being the clergy denominational leaders in largely liberal mainline denominations. The second, you talk about, being those who are genuinely politically and theologically liberal in the Roman Catholic Church in America. But the third one, the one you focus on in the course of your book, the religious left, you say are those who profess to be theologically conservative Protestants. Tell us about them.
Well, yeah, if we can just pick on Ronald Sider to start with. I happen to like Sider. He doesn't like me. He's a genuine believer. He's pro-life, although many people have pointed out that he subordinates a legitimate pro-life agenda to other typical liberal concerns, and we could talk about that later if you like. What you gave, those three kinds of religious left, I present them in a chronological way. It started in the 1930s when a lot of mainline but theologically liberal Protestants lost such confidence in the Bible and lost such respect for the existence of God that they gave up all hope for heaven. They no longer believed in personal salvation or the new birth. And so what they did was they committed themselves to a Soviet political agenda, and they actually believed that God was establishing his kingdom on earth in Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union. A friend of mine once wrote a book titled The Generation That Knew Not Joseph. That would be a good used book to try and find somewhere, how these guys actually made pilgrimages to Russia and were carefully monitored and saw only what the Soviets wanted them to see and heard only what the Soviets wanted them to hear, and came back and worked for the sake of the Soviet Union during the last years of the just before World War II. And then when the Soviet Union, when Stalin signed a treaty with Hitler, they had a little problem with conscience there, because they realized then when Stalin and Hitler had aligned themselves together, these people were becoming treasonous. They were becoming traitors to the United States. Then in the early 1950s, a large number of politically liberal Marxist priests and nuns in Latin America traveled to Europe, where there they were indoctrinated by atheistic professors who were Marxists. And when they went back to Latin America, in this case, most of these people went to South America, they joined radical revolutionary movements. In some cases, they were involved in murders. All of this is part of the history of the liberation theology movement. But then in the late 60s, people like Jim Wallis and Ron Sider were tired of the day when conservative Christians were politically conservative. And they went to the Christian college campuses, and through their publications, they began to argue that genuine Christians would have to be politically liberal. Not to be politically liberal was a sign of sin, and you'd have to repent of that sin. And I remember how many of my own friends in professional organizations were seduced by this particular information. Let's take Tony Campolo. Tony wrote a book 20, 30 years ago called We Have Met the Enemy, and They Are Partly Right. In this book, Tony wrote about 100 pages presenting and defending a new form of Marxism. It really wasn't new. It was connected with a Marxist professor named Herbert Marcuse. But in that book that large numbers of Christians read, it was published, incidentally, by InterVarsity Press. It was published by InterVarsity Press. Not the only book, not the only Marxist-leaning book that InterVarsity Press has published. See, they're all over the place. But Tony persuaded a large number of people that they should thank God for Karl Marx and Herbert Marcuse because of how close the true Marx was to Christian concerns. In fact, I know one professor who teaches at a Southern Baptist university. I won't name him or I won't name the university. The university's located, I won't mention that. But he tells his students that when he reads Marx, Marx reminds him of the Old Testament prophets. I don't think so. I think you'd have to be reading a whole lot into the Old Testament prophets to have Marx remind you of Elijah or Isaiah or Jeremiah. But that's how young kids who haven't been trained properly, perhaps by their parents, go off to college, and then the next time their parents see them 6 to 8 months later, they are liberals or Marxists or worse.
We're talking about the religious left. Dr. Ronald Nash is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Well, I'm wondering about this. How does someone, say you mentioned Tony Campolo, how does he square, or those of his ilk, reading someone like Karl Marx and saying, wow, this sounds like Christian charity to me, and it seems very consistent with Christian charity, when the same Marx would have called all religion, including Christianity, the opiate of the masses, an illusion?
Yeah, that's a good question. But you got to understand, there's a history to the development of Marxian ideas. There are three major kinds of Marxism, maybe four. There was social democratic Marxism, which actually was taken over by Engels after Marx died. This was an interpretation of Marx where the revolution was supposed to be brought about through peaceful democratic means. This is the fountainhead of the kind of socialism that took root in England in the late 1800s. This is also the fountainhead of the kind of Marxism that took place, the socialism that took place in the United States before World War II, social democratic Marxism. The second kind of Marxism was Marxism-Leninism. That was the brainchild of Vladimir Lenin and also taken over then by Stalin and the other thugs who gained control of Russia after World War I. But Tony Campolo is under the influence of a man named Herbert Marcuse. This is a new interpretation of Marx that really came took roots in the early 1930s. It was based on some unpublished writings of Marx. It's an incredible fairy tale of how this thing got started. So Tony Campolo is dealing with a Marx who he can present as a believer, at least a believer in human in humanity. So it's a whole new picture, and my books are one of the few places where you can find out a critical analysis of this new face of Marxism.
With only 2 minutes here, Dr. Nash, there was a third there that you have mentioned in passing, and that would be Jim Wallace. Tell us about him.
Well, I don't know if I can do it in 2 minutes. Jim was born to a Christian family in Detroit. He got mad at his parents' church. He left the Christian faith. I could see somebody leaving his church for what angered Wallace, but to walk away from the Christian faith just because one person in that church was a hypocrite or something else, that's a sign of immaturity. Jim Wallace got aligned with a group called the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, that became very violent. They robbed banks. They bombed buildings. Many of them became the targets of police searches. So Jim Wallace, who at that time was a student at Michigan State University, dropped out of the SDS. He went to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in north of Chicago. And he actually was so persuasive, he turned a number of his professors at that otherwise fine seminary into Marxists. A friend of mine who was a faculty member there at that time told me that he became so committed to Marxism that when he went home to Canada to vote, he always voted for communist candidates, all based on the influence of this one student. Then Wallace got a lot of money. Some of us wonder about where that money came from, and he started this group called Sojourners and the magazine called Sojourners. And you know, and in the time that passed, he wrote three autobiographies. He must think his life story is very important, I guess.
With only 1 minute, we're going to take our break, and we'll continue our conversation on the far side of that break. Dr. Nash, how would you, in less than a minute, how would you describe the scope of the influence? Because some of our listeners are listening and say, well, I've heard of Tony Campolo, but these other guys, I don't know who they are. Maybe their influence is not so great. And I've tried to send my kid to the right college. How would you characterize the scope of the influence of the religious left we've been talking about so far?
Well, oftentimes, you know, this is a trait of a lot of Christians. Sometimes we just trust other people. If they say they love Jesus and so on, we take them at that word. But when you look at the fruit, you know, I've seen a lot of graduates of very fine Christian institutions bring their parents to their knees and their tears when they find out that they spent all that money to send their child to this or that Christian college, and what they've got is a Marxist.
Dr. Ron Nash is our guest, professor of Christian philosophy at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, author of the book The Religious Left, Who They Are and What They Believe. We're talking about the religious left. Feel free to join us, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our conversation with Dr. Ron Nash on the religious left continues after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Except for Jesus Christ, more has been written about Martin Luther than any other figure in world history. But what were the events surrounding the 16th century Reformation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October is The Renaissance and Reformation Movements. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more about the Renaissance and Reformation movements on our website, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. Volume 1 deals with the Renaissance, while Volume 2 covers the Reformation. The Renaissance and Reformation movements details Luther's evangelical thrust, the Roman Empire in crisis, the Reformation in Scotland and England, and the impact of the Renaissance and the Reformation on society and culture. The Renaissance and Reformation Movements, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October, 1-800-325-3040. 3040.
From Muslims fearful of the evil eye to people who say they're Christians but are dancing to make the spirits happy, this Global Minute lets you know these things are part of religious life in the African country of Cote d'Ivoire. A man who grew up in a Muslim home was fearful of death and didn't believe that Islamic teachings answered his concerns. Then he came across a Bible correspondence course and eventually met a missionary with Mission to the World. They met and visited often in Abidjan, the capital city of Cote d'Ivoire. Finally, Siriki gave his life to Christ. Eventually, his father discovered his decision and grabbed a machete and chased Siriki out of the house. But Siriki stood firm in his faith, and to date, he's a pastor with the Reformed churches in Cote d'Ivoire. Pray more Muslims in Cote d'Ivoire will accept Christ. Pray for unreached people around the world with information on the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Some years ago, Newsweek did a cover story titled Teen Depression. According to the National Institutes of Mental Health, 3 million adolescents, that's 2 out of every 5, have symptoms of depression. Depression can lead to academic failure, social isolation, drug abuse, and suicide. Almost 1 in every 5 high school students has thought about suicide, and 2 million have actually made plans to take their lives. And most troubling, symptoms are often waved off as adolescent moods. Dr. Harold Koppelwitz says, parents have to know their children. Adolescence is not a good time to introduce yourself. Money should have been put in the bank earlier. Then, during adolescence, it's a continuation of a close relationship. Isn't that the way of Christian love? Not only for depression, but for so many other problems in life? Instead of spiritual bromides, have faith, pray, you'll be okay, all things work together for good. Instead of copping out with quick fix platitudes, which don't solve the deep brokenness of our sinful world, take up the cross for the long haul. 1 Corinthians 13 says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. So, spend lots of time with your children.
On the next Focus on the Family.
Some girls grow up in homes with loving parents where there is a lot of guidance and instruction, and yet something goes haywire.
Yeah.
And moms get lost in the craziness as well as daughters during that time.
Author Sharon Hirsch and Dr. James Dobson offer advice to parents who are trying to navigate their teens' emotional storms on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Saying, what does it mean, my brother, to say you have faith if there are no deeds? Faith without works is dead.
That, of course, was Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry speaking at a church in Philadelphia last weekend, quoting from one of his favorite Bible passages from the book of James. Dr. Ron Nash is our guest. We're talking about religious left. Dr. Nash, look, I am cynical, and my listeners will note this, I'm cynical about any politician, left or right, quoting scripture, including George W. Bush. But where is the outrage from the religious left when Senator John Kerry so freely and so often nowadays is quoting from the Bible?
Well, they're ideologues, and they lack the ability, the discernment to recognize phoniness when they see it, okay? Now, I know a number of things about George W. Bush that have convinced me that his faith is genuine. He's a born-again believer. He certainly supports our values on such matters as being opposed to abortion, being pro-life, the support of private Christian schools, homeschooling. So the difference between these two men is the difference between night and day. George Bush, in my opinion, is a genuine article, and I think every time we watch Mr. Kerry, what we see is a man changing his mind in response to the political winds at that particular moment. Incidentally, let me just mention how people might get more information about my book. We intentionally make it hard. We want true believers, so we make it hard for people to get. And they would just, I don't normally give my email address out, but they're probably going to, if anybody wants to get a hold of this book or find out how to get it, they should email me at ronnsh@AOL. And I'll repeat that later on, ronnsh@AOL, and I can tell them how to get it.
Dr. Nash, I'm wondering, given what you just said in response to that Carrie cut we played, Ronald Reagan was a member of the Presbyterian Church USA, very liberal mainline Protestant denomination. George W. Bush Sr., we'll call him, the Episcopal Church USA, say no more about its liberal pedigree there. George W. Bush, our current president, he is a member of the United Methodist Church. All three of these very conservative presidents have been members of very liberal church bodies. And in contrast, former President Bill Clinton, former President Jimmy Carter, are both members of one of the more conservative denominations, the Southern Baptist Convention.
Don't pardon me, but I'm a Southern Baptist, all right? And don't make Bill Clinton one of us, please.
But he is a member of the church.
Well, he may be. He may be. But he has not. Listen, I know, if you want to talk someday about Bill Clinton and the Southern Baptist Convention, I'll be glad to do that. But I know too much, and we don't want to take up our time on that.
Well, why the contrast between politically conservative presidents being members of theologically liberal church bodies and politically liberal presidents being members of, at least ostensibly members of, very conservative church body?
Well, let me just say this about Clinton and the Southern Baptist Church. He sang in the choir, and he was on state television every Sunday morning. A lot of people think he did that for nothing more than the political value. And I doubt very much if Bill Clinton has walked into a... there are liberal Southern Baptist churches, too. And there's a very good chance that Bill Clinton traveled widely in the liberal Southern Baptist circles. That man, let's not recount his moral and theological problems, okay? But in the case of George Bush, I want to believe that the United Methodist Church to which he is a member is a conservative one. He's got a black pastor. One of the problems there is that a lot of the difficulties that occur in these cases is that due to the fact that people who are in high political office don't understand subtleties and nuances of theological differences. I do know that the church that Bush attends in Washington, D.C. is a conservative church. At least I have a pretty good word for that. I think this deserves some consideration when we have a little more time. But I think there are, and this is an interesting topic to discuss, but there are things that go on that aren't always obvious on the surface of things.
Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. On the line, Cindy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Dr. Nash, I find your remarks quite interesting because about 30 years ago, my husband and I were members of the Lutheran Church in America, which is now the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and our pastor tried to influence us with Sojourners magazine, and he was and wanted us to become part of that movement. And upon looking at this material, I realized it was very social, gospel-oriented, and kind of socialist in nature. And I, kind of gave it back to him and said, thanks, but no thanks. Because we weren't interested in that kind of thing at all.
Well, it's also pro-homosexual. It's got, when I read Sojourners, and I read it just to see what Jim Wallis has got to say this particular month or something else, it is obvious to me that this is really not a Christian publication, but I appreciate the discernment that you and your husband showed. So just as you saw that in the case of your pastor at that time, That would also have been true in the case of colleges that are connected with that particular denomination, all right? Now, I happen to know the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. I was born and raised in that movement. My father was a member of that movement. But that's a different branch of Lutheranism, and you'll find a great deal greater, a much greater laxity about theological matters and social and cultural matters in that particular denomination.
Gary is on the line. Gary, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, sir. When the whole topic kind of came up, is, you know, Marxism is one of those terms that you kind of recognize, but you can't quite nail it down. So I appreciate it. Yeah, if you guys would kind of give a definition of it, maybe, you know, back during Stalin's time, and maybe how it might have changed now, and, you know, and just basically what Marxism is, basically.
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Nash, you do outline, that, and you mentioned it before, three different brands of Marxism, kind of classical, then there's a different position, then there's neo-Marxism. Very briefly for our caller.
What is it? What is neo-Marxism?
As opposed to Marx's writings and his original thought.
Okay. It gets kind of complicated, but I go into details in the book on the religious left and other books. In 1843-44, Marx wrote some sociological treatises. In those that was several years before he and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. Marx never published those 1843-44 manuscripts during his lifetime, which to me means he recognized that they were shallow and unimportant. But when they were published in 1932, notice, it took almost 80 years for these things to get published in a German translation, a number of people on the continent began to think that this was a new Marx, one who was not supportive of dictatorships like Stalin's and so on. Many of those people then got murdered by Marxist-Leninists, or they ended up in Soviet concentration camps. But one Marxist in particular, who happened to be a German communist named Herbert Marcuse, he fled Hitler. He came to the United States. He taught at Brandeis University, and then he taught at some other schools. And he made up a whole new theory of ideas that had really nothing at all to do with the historic Marx. But this is what fascinated Tony Campolo, because almost every student who got a graduate degree in sociology ended up a neo-Marxist. They ended up with a new kind of psychology or psychotherapy along these lines. And that's about all the time we have to give it today. But if you ever find my book, Poverty and Wealth, or let me give you an Internet site, www.biblicaltraining.org. www.biblicaltraining.org, you can find a series of lectures that I gave here and there, and I go into greater detail about this neo-Marxism that is now represented in the thinking of Tony Campolo.
And I do recommend Dr. Nash's book, Poverty of Wealth, very eye-opening on that particular issue. Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-730-2727. Jerry is on the line. Jerry, welcome.
Hi. And hi, Dr. Nash. I don't know if you're familiar with the former Jesuit Malachi Martin. He wrote many books. One of them he wrote was The Jesuits. He's a former Jesuit. He never left the Pope, but he did leave the order. We always sponsored the Pope for some reason. Liberation Theology of Jesuits is what the book's all about, and it is a theology of Marxists, of kind of a Marxist-type philosophy that the Jesuits teach to or bring to the third world countries of South America, Latin America, and that I know for sure. I don't know of the other third world countries.
Jerry, thank you. Are you aware of this writing?
No, I'm not aware of this writing, but it sounds like any one of 100 other books on liberation theology that do exist and have existed. And it is tragic when you think that Jesuits have been carrying a Marxist message to nations in Latin America, but this is a part of the history of the religious left movement.
You mentioned before, early in our conversation, how this present pope has managed to bring liberation theology under control in much of the world, except North America. How much has Roman Catholicism been influenced by liberation theology?
Oh, an enormous influence. Now, of course, John Paul II has lost a lot of his strength, and but during the worst years of liberation theology, especially when he came to Central and Latin America, he would shake his finger at priests and bishops, including in Nicaragua, and threaten them with excommunication. Because what they were doing is they were putting the Marxist gospel ahead of the Christian gospel. And even though I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Southern Baptist, I give thanks for the Pope that he did that. But of course, this stuff has taken root in Catholic seminaries in Latin, in North America now. It has taken root in Protestant seminaries, and it is still there. And I could name some of those seminaries, and some of you would be shocked because there are seminaries connected with your denominations. This stuff is dangerous stuff.
In about 20 minutes, we're going to pick up our conversation with Pastor Will Wheaton on Philip, Deacon and Evangelist. We're talking about this biblical saint, Pastor Will Wheaton of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, in about 20 minutes here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the religious left. Dr. Ron Nash is our guest, professor of Christian philosophy at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and author of the book, The Religious Left, Who They Are and What They Believe. 1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number. Herman is on the line from Illinois. Herman, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. Like that, Dr. Nash, even the old Stalinist communists considered homosexuality a decadent bourgeois indulgence. How does it come around that these neo-Marxists have now made that lifestyle what they claim to be the vanguard of a remake and a makeover of society?
Thank you, Herman.
Yeah, well, Herman's right. Ideologies change, and my guess is, with all of the information we're getting about the spread of HIV and AIDS in Russia, that the old Marxists have changed a bit. It is true that in the 1930s, you could not be it's my understanding, at least, that you could not be a member of the Communist Party in the United States and be a practicing, known, recognized homosexual. But the Sojourners magazine, even though it claims to be an evangelical publication, it regards lesbians and homosexuals as a persecuted minority, and Jim Wallace is going to stand and give up whatever other parts of the Christian faith he thinks are dispensable, but he's not going to give up his support for homosexuality and lesbianism.
You spend an entire chapter talking about a document that brings the three individuals that you focus on in your book, Jim Wallace, Ron Sider, and Tony Campolo, together. The document's called The Cry for Renewal. Tell us about this and what it means for the religious left.
Well, you see, every major election, these fellas have to activate, get themselves activated, and they have to publish something. And I guess in the course of my books, I mention everything that they've published in connection with every election. They sort of have to get the faithful all excited. And so they produce this particular document, or else they distributed it. There are a couple of them, and I may get one or the other of them mixed up. But to read what they advocate, in fact, now that my memory is clicking a little bit here, what they did was they got a large number of the leading theological liberals in America together in support of this particular document. Now, no one pays any attention to it. The only way you'd probably hear that they even did this sort of thing is by reading my book. But there is no moderation on the part of these people. They are wholly committed to this left wing agenda, and if anybody crosses them, you know, you're going to get criticized. I understand that Ron Sider is working right now with National Association of Evangelicals to try and persuade large numbers of conservative Christians to vote for John Kerry, because this is what God demands of us. You see.
You have written, one disturbing feature of the evangelical left is its almost total silence about theological liberalism, and you go on to talk about the connection between theological liberalism, you even at one point call it apostasy, and the precipitous decline of mainline liberal denominations. What is the religious left doing to some of what used to be the pillars of American Protestantism, the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, USA, the Episcopal Church USA.
Well, here again is an astounding piece of information. Tony Campolo is a Northern Baptist, or so I understand, which, of course, has gone largely liberal in opposition to the Southern Baptist Convention, which had a liberal strain in it for many years, but finally the liberals were persuaded to just take their heresy somewhere else. Tony Campolo has written a book defending the liberal mainline denominations, with their repudiation of the deity of Christ, with their repudiation of the virgin birth of Jesus and the bodily resurrection of Christ. And in doing that, Tony has really made it clear where his heart is. His heart is not with evangelicals, even though evangelicals give him many speaking engagements to huge crowds of upwards of 20,000 Christian kids. Tony wants politically and theologically liberal mainline Protestants to appreciate him. And he's far more at home, I believe, he's far more at home with these theological liberals than he is with the evangelical movement, who give him most of his income and most of his audiences.
Jim is on the line calling from his car. Jim, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Dr. Nash?
I'm fine, thanks.
Listen, we had Tony Campolo. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and he came and spoke at our university church in Loma Linda a couple months ago, and I didn't notice anything in regards to him being less liberal for homosexuals. He said that those people need to be accepted by Christ, but we should never accept their behavior. We should draw their behavior into the biblical, what God expects of them, but we still need to accept them as Christians.
Thank you.
Tony judges his audiences very effectively, okay? And if Tony ever did anything different than that, his ministry among evangelicals would be over. But Tony is a multidimensional person, and in my book I talk about his adeptness at leaving the reservation when his audience is not going to be as concerned about where he stands on certain issues. There is a website somewhere on the internet. I used to be able to get it by just typing in Tony's name, Tony Campolo, and then letting my browser look for it. Now he's got a lot of pages. That's on Google, is it? Anyway, there is in that segment of writings about 32 pages of people who have done enormous research on Tony, and I would urge you to try and find that. I've got a copy in my office. It was given to me by a Presbyterian pastor, as a matter of fact. There are a lot of different sides to Tony Campolo, and what he says before one audience is not necessarily what he's going to say before another audience.
The target of so much of the religious left's animosity, and one of you might call it fear-mongering, is the Christian Coalition. Is there any corollary to the Christian Coalition in the religious left? Any organization, as loose as it may be, organized in the religious left?
Well, that's what Ron Sider is trying to do right now. And for this election, through the National Association of Evangelicals, they have hired him, or they've asked him to do this on their behalf. So that Christians, get this, Christians will recognize that we have no God-given reason why we should regard ourselves as conservatives, that there are times when Christians need to be liberal, okay? So what I found is that there is the kind of agreement among these people that's a little bit like the conspiracy, and I'm not afraid of that word, the conspiracy that exists among the major representatives of the media, like the Dan Rather case, or there's a new embarrassment for ABC. You can find out about these things on the Internet. So when it doesn't happen to be public and observable, it just means that they've been laying low for a little while, like in the case of this publication we talked about a few minutes ago. At that particular time, they went, I think, to the Capitol building. They went outside the Capitol building with liberal Democrats. So they're doing these things, but they're not always in the public eye. And they're far more dangerous, in my opinion, than anything that one could ever track back to the religious right.
With only less than a minute here, Dr. Nash, before we need to conclude, what about the National Council of Churches? Could that be considered one of the public faces of the religious left?
Well, yeah. There you have a whole group of people whose only real agenda is not theological, unless it's to destroy the faith, in my opinion. Their real message is a political agenda, which, among other things, is to defeat George W. Bush and elect whoever the liberal Democratic candidate happens to be at the particular moment. They've been kind of quiet recently during this election, unless they're doing things publicly that most of us are not noticing. Look, before we break, let me just give people my email address again if they care to get some more information. It's RONNSH, that is my name without the A, RONNSH at AOL.
Dr. Ron Nash is professor of Christian philosophy at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's author of the book, The Religious Left, Who They Are and What They Believe. Dr. Nash, thank you for being our guest.
Okay, thank you.
That email address again, if you'd like information on that book, it's RONNSH, no A in there, RONNSH at AOL.com. The title of the book, The Religious Left. In the next hour, we're going to be talking with Pastor Will Wheaton for the first 25 minutes of the program about Philip, deacon and evangelist. This biblical saint is remembered today in the church's calendar. Pastor Wheaton, of course, is a regular guest and pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Then, in the next part of that second hour, Father Robert Sanders joins us. He has written an article for Christianity Today very recently titled The Ecstatic Heresy. We're going to talk about the heresy of subjectivism. Feelings over facts. Feelings over genuine faith. Father Robert Sanders will join us. And then in the third hour, we've got excerpts, the significant excerpts, from Friday's presidential debate between Senator John Kerry and President George W. Bush. The two questions that I was interested in hearing and having you hear if you didn't have the opportunity to see it for yourself, and we'll be reviewing it there in the third hour, a question on embryonic stem cell research, and also there's a question that's really about abortion, but it was framed as a question about, well, what judge would you appoint if you were elected president? We'll be talking about all of that in the third hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkins. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.